Good morning, and welcome to the inaugural podcast, Wise River Advisors. Today, we're going to interview John Savercool. John is the Managing Director, Senior Lobbyist for UBS Americas. John has spent 34 years in Washington, working for numerous congresspeople and senators in various capacities. Today, we're going to discuss the current political landscape and how changes in both the executive and legislative branches will impact policy. John, on behalf of my partners, Glenn, Craig, Scott, Austin, and Erica, thank you so much for being here.
What you feel the most impactful implications of the Biden administration will be, with consideration to the thin margin that the Democrats hold in the Senate and the limiting impact that'll have on the Democrat administration and leadership to get things done. What do you think the administration will be able to get done? What is it that they hope to do that they will not be able to get done? And then maybe we can, you know, in that conversation, focus on both taxes and fiscal policy.
Sure, Craig. And I think that's a great question to start with. Certainly, with any change in administration, we're going to see a different, we're going to see a change in policy priorities. And this year will be different. Joe Biden was just inaugurated and confirmed as our president just 30 minutes or so ago, maybe a little longer. So he is actually our president and will begin the day, or will end the day rather, signing a number of executive orders that will reverse various executive orders that were put into effect by President Trump. I think more broadly, the Biden focus will clearly be on COVID, trying to advance our nation's defense against COVID, trying to specifically improve the vaccine process, make sure that vaccine manufacturing is occurring at the clip that we need it to, make sure that people are taking advantage of the dosages that are available, that have been made available to the state. So I think that is his first, that will be his first priority, really lasting for as it needs to get our country back in better shape from a health perspective, from an economic perspective. In that light, you may have seen that he unveiled a $1.9 trillion bill last week that he believes will help get us out of the COVID mess sooner. That will be the subject of debate in the House and Senate over the next couple of weeks. That'll be a big deal. Some of the fights you saw last year between Republicans and Democrats about wanting to spend a certain amount of money, that will occur again. And keep in mind that such a vote will require 60 votes in the Senate. And you'll have the familiar arguments here with Democrats fully supporting the bill and most Republicans feeling like it's a little too much and we ought to be more selective in our spending. And so they will try to settle on a smaller bill. And that's the debate we'll see over the next couple of weeks. I think beyond that, the Biden administration certainly plans to bring forward a tax bill. They want to pursue a tax bill because the tax bill will generate revenues that it can use to apply to new spending that the administration wants to do. And they also see it as an income inequality problem solver, redistribute some funds, help out those at the lower end of the scale. So there will be a tax increase proposal put forward. It will certainly target corporations and wealthy individuals. I think those are two givens as part of the debate. I think that the administration will claim that the tax increases will be used to pay for a big infrastructure bill that I think most Americans want. So you might see the tax bill paired with an infrastructure bill and other spending. And I think those will be the big issues in the first 6 months. Obviously, the president will spend a lot of time getting his nominees confirmed. He needs his team in place to be able to do what he wants to do. The Senate held hearings yesterday on the on the nominees covering the state Treasury and Homeland Security departments, as well as the Defense Department. They will be confirmed in the next day or so. Biden will begin to have his team. But all those staff people underneath are going to require Senate confirmation. And so really the focus will be on these nominations, the COVID and passing a COVID bill and further down the road, a tax bill paired with an infrastructure bill. Just one last note about you mentioned the breakdown of the House and Senate. This will certainly limit what President Biden can do. There's a 50-50 majority in the Senate. They only have a majority because they have the vice president, who is technically the president of the Senate, can cast the tie-breaking votes. The House majority of Democrats is much smaller than it was last year. So Democrats are going to likely need a Republican vote or two unless they get all of their members behind the Biden plan. And when you talk about a big tax bill, that's really going to separate some Democrats and probably result in some Democrats not wanting to support the package because it increases taxes on X or Y or in a constituency that they believe is important. So I think that the tax bill that we will ultimately see toward the summer or so will not be as ambitious as we've heard the Democrats discuss over the last couple of months. It will contain higher taxes on businesses, on individuals making a lot of money, probably over $300,000 or $400,000. We will see other taxes aimed at those groups, but it won't be as wide and broad as I think some have feared over the last couple of months.
Taxes, what is the likelihood, given the construct of the Senate, the razor-thin margin at 50-50, what is the likelihood for capital gains taxes to be increased? I know there was some talk prior to the election that maybe even for high-income earners, that rate might go as high as the ordinary income tax rate. Is that likely to pass, or are there any other specifics that you can share that you think might be in, you know, either we were considering and they're not going to happen, or that you think will likely to happen?
Yeah, Craig, I think I've been asked the most by our clients about potential changes to not only the cap gains tax, but the estate tax as well. And I think that these are areas that are going to be a little more challenging to put in the bill. I do think that there will be a big effort by Democrats to increase the tax on cap gains. I don't think it will be made parallel to ordinary income. I think it'll be something less. I think many Democrats will start at the point of taxing cap gains as ordinary income, but they'll settle for a fallback position. So I would be surprised if there aren't additional taxes on cap gains, but I would be very surprised if that rate was the ordinary income rate. So something less, I think, is more feasible. With regard to the estate tax, there are a couple of Democrats who are on record for opposing any increase in the estate tax. I'm thinking of two Democratic senators in particular, and then there are several other Democrats representing agricultural states that have always been lukewarm on any changes to the estate tax because of its impact on family farms. So I would be surprised if there was any kind of adverse impact on estates coming out of this bill, although there would be a lot of noise in that regard, and maybe the initial bill will propose that. So I think both issues, cap gains and estate tax, will be part of the debate. They'll be part of the noise that you and I and others hear about from Washington as a part of this debate. I think the end result will be something smaller than what is initially feared. I think that, again, most of the focus will be on raising that top rate, individual rate, and putting the corporate rate to about 28 or 30%. That's the big revenue raiser, the corporate rate. And remember, Democrats want to raise a lot of money because they want to spend a lot of new money. And they can only spend the money if they raise it, or that's what they're supposed to do under the rules. So they'll be incentivized to really go after the big, high price items that really generate a lot of revenue. The biggest one is that corporate rate back up to 28%.
Do you think a lot of our clients reside in high tax states and saw the limitation on your ability to deduct state and local taxes and real estate taxes? Is going to be part of the tax bill where they eliminate the restriction and allow people again to deduct state tax against the federal income tax?
Mark, I think that SALT will certainly be addressed by Democrats in their initial bill and the administration's bill. You know, this is obviously a big issue with Democrats. It hits mostly blue states. So clearly Democrats are interested in trying to restore the situation with regard to state and local taxes that we had years ago, where we had a kind of an open deduction. I think the Democrats will run into trouble in defending that position as the debate evolves. One, because that's going to cost a lot of money. So Democrats are going to have to recoup that money somehow. It's actually a big bonus to the federal treasury to have that money. And I think that many Democrats will find it hard to defend when there will be studies that will show that it disproportionately affects high-income earners and wealthier individuals. So I think they run into some optics issues that will probably result in some relief for folks from those states, but not the full relief that you just outlined. Maybe we'll see an expansion of the cap or something like that, but I don't think you're going to see a restoration of the tax status that existed years ago before the 2017 tax cuts were put into effect that affected SALT. So I think partial relief, but not full relief, and maybe unsatisfactory to many of our blue state clients.
So I'm gonna switch gears a little bit on you and talk about foreign policy a little bit. You know, obviously, pretty concerned about, you know, China and some of the issues that we've been reading about and learning about over time. And obviously, China, you know, being a strategic threat to the United States over a long period of time, both economically and maybe even militarily. The Trump administration took a very hard line against China. What do you see as the Biden administration's approach? Do you think they continue to sort of take that harder line, or do they have a more conciliatory response and relationship with China?
Well, I think the answer is probably both. First of all, if you look at what the Trump administration has done in China, he's really opened the door to rallying most people in the United States against China. I mean, he successfully pointed out some of the discrepancies we have in our trade relationship, in our economic relationship, and in the threat status that China poses to the U.S. So I think President Trump was successful in creating the public opinion in America now that China is our primary national security threat. I'm not sure that if Americans were polled 5 years ago, they would have identified China as our primary threat. So now they do. And I think with that political dynamic in mind, Joe Biden has no other option really than to be tough on China. I think he will try to be conciliatory in his choice of words. Certainly, we all know he has a very different style than President Trump. So that may be effective with the Chinese, or it may be perceived as weakness. We just don't really know yet. But I think he will try to be conciliatory to the point he can. But I think he also knows he needs to be tough on China. It's good politics, and it's probably the right policy to get the U.S. more aligned with China on certain trade issues, make sure that we have access to their markets, that the trade environment and the technology environment is more fair. So I think that President Biden will be strong in ways that he believes are strong. So we'll continue to see pressure on China. The tariffs will probably remain for a little longer. They'll certainly utilize our allies to present a multi-country front against China rather than just a U.S. approach. We'll see how effective that is. I think President Biden intends to be tough on China. Whether the Chinese perceive that, we'll just have to see. But I think that really it's likely that any president we see in the U.S., whether it's President Biden or whoever's president after 2024, will be tough on China, because that's what the political dynamic calls for. And I think most people believe that the reality is that the U.S. and China are in at least an economic Cold War, and maybe worse. And if that's the case, then a tough approach on China is required and is politically smart.
John, what do you think the impact on the Republican Party in the wake of the Trump presidency and what appears to be a fracturing of those that were highly supportive of the president, you know, certainly in the last 6 months of his administration and since the election, breaking into those who seem to be supporting the president, that seem to be breaking away from the president? What do you think the short and intermediate term implications to the political dynamic will be as a result of that fracture.
Yeah, Craig, I think it's going to be a big challenge for the Republican Party to rebuild itself, at least right now. You know, both parties have shown great resiliency over the years in suffering defeats and being at a low point, but then bouncing back several years later. So I certainly wouldn't count Republicans out, but I think they do have a significant challenge. If President Trump stays in the Republican Party, at least for the next year, he'll still be the dominant person in the party because he'll be speaking every day. And I'm sure he'll have some media job or opportunity where he'll be expressing his views every night. His Twitter will continue. He will continue to plug in people who support him very strongly. There is clearly a part of the Republican Party that wants nothing to do with Trump. Where they go and how they separate remains to be seen. If President Trump pursues the path he suggested yesterday, that forming a third party, the Patriot Party, might be his option, then Republicans have their answer. They will rebuild without him. Of course, that means that the Trump supporters would not be with them, and that would put him at a big disadvantage, assuming Trump is able to hold those people going forward. So it's a big challenge. I think that the reality is that the rebuilding of the Republican Party won't be so much about what Republicans do, but it will be more about how the Democrats do. If the Biden administration fumbles the ball on many occasions and doesn't do well, then the Republicans are going to be a viable alternative just because of the failure of Democrats. If you look back at our most recent elections, the last four or five, I would argue that most people, when they go cast their votes, have really casted their vote against someone rather than for someone. So Republicans don't have to fully rebuild and be a perfect party in 2024. They just have to be perceived as better than the other party based on the performance that they saw over the last 4 years. We have no idea how President Biden will do. He may be a very good president. He may be a very mediocre president. But I think that's going to have a bigger impact on the rebuilding of the Republican Party than anything Republicans do. If you look at Democrats, they were largely in disarray in their primary. You know, they had 20 people running for office. Republicans had 15 or 20 in 2016. Both parties have really been in a state of disarray, but they've been unified, at least for the time being, by the election of Joe Biden. It seems at first glance that Republicans have a mess on their hands, and they do, but unity is a lot easier when the other side makes mistakes. And I suspect that when 2024 comes around, we're going to have another competitive race. And I don't know who the candidates will be, but it'll be close. I think that's where the American people are. I think they're divided along conservative liberal lines, and that will still be the case in 2024.
So I was going to ask you sort of a personal question. So you've been in Washington for 30 plus years. You know a lot of senators and congressmen and a lot of people in positions of influence, and you've seen a lot of different administrations, different congresses. And I guess my question is, one, you know, is the fracture within the government, the sort of left versus right, the political ideologies that are opposing one another, is this something that is sort of being overblown by media? And you know, look, you've been around a long time and you've seen a lot of this, and there's always been left and right, and there always will be. Or is this something, you know, that is more extreme than we've seen in the past? And what do you see, you know, as you talk to people that you know in the seat of power, do you see them coming together at all and starting to sort of bridge some of the divide and work together to try to accomplish some common goals? Or is it just going to be sort of more of the same?
Mark, I'll give you my personal view. And, you know, I've been watching Congress since 1981. So back at the beginning of the Reagan administration, that's when I got out of school and started my career in Washington. Back when I was a younger man, the Congress had a very different makeup. Like the makeup today, if you're a Republican in the House or Senate, you're very likely to be very conservative. If you're a Democrat in the House or Senate, you're likely to be very liberal. there aren't a lot of people in between. There are very few moderate Democrats or moderate Republicans. There are some, but there aren't enough to really make a difference. When I was a younger guy, the equation was much different. We had a lot of moderate Democrats, a lot of moderate Republicans. They were the governing majority. So the extremes of the parties were kind of irrelevant. Back in that, you had Republicans from the Northeast. You had Democrats from the South. Today, you have very few. So the makeup of the Congress was very different. And so I think that one of the reasons there is so much division in Washington, and it is real. It's not made up. It's very real, and it's very obstructionist to laws being passed. And it's not overblown by the media, but it is amplified by the media in ways that you and I and others on the call see every day. You know, we turn on the TV and we're likely to go to our favorite cable station, whether it's MSNBC or Fox. We get a dose of their views on the issues. We know they're slanted, but we're comfortable with them because they reflect our views and they reinforce them. And I think that the effect of that over time has been for people's political views to be hardened. And I would ask you and Craig and others on the call, have your views been hardened over the last decade? Have you had a conversation with someone who you're close to, a family member, a friend? Have you had a political conversation that's been uncomfortable and maybe has caused a fissure or some break in that relationship? I would bet that most people would say yes to that. And I think it's the reflection of the time. So as we elect people with harder views, whether they're on the right or left, those views are amplified by the media. They put pressure on the lawmakers to act in their extreme views. Not extreme, but they're very conservative or very liberal views. I mean, those are not illegitimate views, but when you're on one side or the other, it's hard to come to the middle. And very few members of Congress are in the middle. And we just don't get a lot of bipartisanship, mostly for that reason. Philosophies are different here. And the people who they represent, their philosophies are different because they're amplified and fed by the media every day in ways that didn't exist back in 1980 and 85 and 1990. So it's a very different time. It does present a big challenge for us. It's hard to pass laws today unless there's an emergency or a crisis that really require it. People generally will rally together. But just common everyday problems that need to be solved in Washington, you know, how to pay for infrastructure, how to pass certain laws, that how to pass police reform laws, how to pass other kind of economic growth laws that have generally been non-controversial in the past. Everyone puts a political spin on them and they're very hard to pass. It's a big problem. The president, whoever the president is, whether it's Biden or whether it was Trump or Obama, have a big role to play in forcing compromise and in trying to rally the nation to compromise. And frankly, I don't think we've had a president in a long time that's done that very well. And it's really up to the president to set the tone. So perhaps we'll see a different tone this year. I think the nation needs it to bring people together.
The razor-thin margin of the Senate is a mitigating factor for President Biden's agenda. On the table prior to the election were things like the elimination of the filibuster, which would make it easier for the Senate to pass laws that maybe would otherwise be considered unreachable. With more moderate senators in the middle, although there's few, there are a handful of Joe Manchin who sits with the Democrats, but is squarely in the middle. He will be a mitigating factor. Are there policies that you think that will get through with arm twisting of those sort of more moderate senators? Or do you think that the outlook for more moderation is intact and that those sort of middle of the road senators will hold the line against more, you know, dramatic changes?
Well, you're right in the 50-50 makeup in the Senate. really does put a premium on those members who are more moderate. And the key question that has to be addressed immediately by Democrats is what 10 Republicans, assuming all 50 Democrats vote for a Democratic-led bill, what 10 Republicans can we get that will meet the requirements of the filibuster so that we get 60 votes? And when we look at that list of Republicans, there's probably, you know, there's a few of them who come to mind, you know, Senator Susan Collins from Maine, Senator Mitt Romney. There are a few others, but there probably aren't 10. And I think what will happen is that you won't see a lot of bills pass initially. You won't see a lot of significant compromises made by either Republicans or Democrats to get to that 60 vote threshold. And I think frustration will settle into the Democratic Party at some point. And I think they will probably seek to eliminate the filibuster requirement, not this year, but probably maybe sometime next year. They want to give Republicans a chance to oppose what they're going to do before they have a basis eliminating the filibuster next year. Right now, there are two Democrats, including Senator Manchin, who you mentioned, and one of the Arizona senators, Democratic senators, who have said that they will in no way support the elimination of the filibuster. So right now, they're two votes shy. They only need 50 votes to do that. That's an internal Senate rule that only requires a majority. So they would need 50. Two Democrats have indicated that they're not going to support that. A couple of other senators have indicated that they may not. They have apprehension about it. With a little arm twisting, perhaps they could be persuaded. It's not going to happen this year, but it could happen next year. And it may happen next year because keep in mind that Democrats are operating under a timetable of 2 years. They have this year and next year to pass as much as they can and to make their case to the American people before we have the midterm elections in 2022. So in 2022, we have one third of the Senate up. We have every House of Representatives member is up for re-election. With razor thin majorities in both chambers, there will be an all out bonsai charge and frantic effort to win those elections. So Democrats don't know if they're going to have a majority in the House or Senate in 2023. They know they'll have Joe Biden as president for another 2 years, but they don't know if they're going to have a majority in the House or Senate. So the agenda is going to be very front loaded. If there's going to be any effort to eliminate the filibuster, it's going to happen after Democrats believe they have a case of showing Republican obstructionism and then lifting it and hoping that the American people will accept that. And I don't think that'll happen until next year. So this year, they'll have to pass what they can via 60 votes. There's some votes that can occur with 50. The tax bill is one of them. Nominations can occur with 50 votes. So some things will pass, but big policy items like trying to get police reforms through or a prescription drug pricing bill done or passing the minimum wage increase, those things will all need 60. And they will not happen this year unless both sides decide to compromise more than they have been. And I don't think they will because they'll see 2022 as an opportunity for them to regain the party, have the Republicans maybe flip the House or Senate, and they don't have to take these votes. So I think you will see the filibuster ended next year. You'll see a very active 2022 in addition to this year.
With regard to technology companies, and we're seeing on the left and the right some frustration. It's interesting, Mika Brzezinski on her show came out and railed against Mark Zuckerberg and said, you know, basically saying, you know, these companies need to be shut down. So on the left, there's some frustration. On the right, there's frustration about, you know, censoring certain points of view and not allowing certain platforms to be on servers or not allowing certain individuals to participate in Twitter and their ecosphere. So the question I would have for you, is there an appetite by the left and the right where maybe they come together and rein in technology companies or try to, you know, break them apart? I know there's numerous lawsuits against technology, antitrust lawsuits that states have filed. Is there an appetite in Washington to take on this issue, or is it perceived that it is an issue in Washington?
There certainly is an appetite in Washington to tackle all of the issues you just mentioned and to kind of more broadly take on big tech. The Congress has traditionally pursued technology issues very gently because the reality is not a lot of people in Congress know a lot about technology. These are mostly people my age or older. They barely know how to turn on their computers. They don't know a lot about how technology works. They've been very cautious about addressing tech issues because they don't really know the business very well. What they've done over the last couple of years, you've seen the technology companies and their size and their market dominance be a big issue over the years. Really, what the lawmakers and what the Trump administration has done is to try to put pressure on the tech companies to change their business models to reflect some of these concerns, hoping that the tech companies would change this or that, do things that would accommodate some of the concerns raised by people. With the censorship issues now and with the focus on the liability shield that tech companies have against lawsuits contesting some of the comments made on their platforms, there is a much broader interest in Congress now to examine tech industry practices, their market shares, their market dominance. So I think you'll see a lot of hearings on it this year in both the House and the Senate. You'll see things like antitrust reforms advanced. You'll see a lot of talk about eliminating the liability shield they have. But I think it's going to be harder to pass a final bill. You're right in that there are pieces of the far right and far left that both want to do this. I still think there's going to be a little hesitance in Congress in wanting to only move forward if they're absolutely certain of what they're doing. Because, you know, technology is kind of still the golden child industry. It's needed in America. We want them to be as innovative as they can. There will be concerns about smothering them with laws, regulations, trust restrictions, things like that. So we need a strong and vibrant and competitive tech industry. And I think members will be a little hesitant to be very aggressive or ambitious in what their policy proposals do. I think what's more likely is a lot of belly aching, a lot of complaining, a lot of calling in the tech companies for hearings, complaining about them. I'm not sure what the final verdict on legislation will be. With regards to breaking the companies up, we'll see if the Biden administration pursues that. I would think that they certainly would if President Biden had nominated a more aggressive attorney general. He really nominated a kind of a status quo mainstream attorney general who doesn't have as strong of an antitrust record as someone else might. So I think you might see some antitrust action in the executive branch, but I think you'll see Congress a little hesitate to act real ambitiously. But you'll hear a lot of noise, a lot of complaints, but final legislation, I'm not so sure. I'd say right now a little under 50% of that, although we'll certainly hear a lot about it.
John, a quick final question. If taxes are increased, if they're able to push that through, what would be the timing of that? Would tax rates go up in 2022 or 2021?
Yeah, so if you look back at the tax bills over the last 20 years or so, the way that they've addressed the effective dates of different provisions is very different. So in every bill, there have been provisions made retroactive to the current year, and other provisions have made effective for the following year or for even years in the future. I think that what Biden does will likely be a mix. But if the economy is still in a struggling situation when Biden takes on this debate, he will be under considerable pressure to make sure that the tax changes are made applicable to the next year, not the current year. I think that investors and businesses and others impacted by the increases will have a good case to make that, you know, they're not only being subject to a big tax whammy, but they're being subject to a retroactive tax whammy that would kind of double their pain. So I think that Biden would be hard pressed not to insist that ultimately those tax increases are effective in the following year, especially if the bill is considered in the second half of the year, which I think it will be, it's just much more sensible to make sure that the changes are effective the next year rather than the current year. I could be wrong on that, and we'll just have to see, because Democrats will raise more revenue if the tax increases are made retroactively. So they'll raise more money. That'll be appealing to them. They'll be able to spend more on infrastructure or whatever spending they want to attach to the tax bill. I think at the end of the day, the political environment will probably dictate that we'll see more applications for or effective dates be for 2022 rather than 2021.
We wanted to thank you for spending, 45 minutes with us discussing, your view on where you see sort of the political landscape, how you think things will be done in Washington over the 2 and 4 years, and what the implications are for a number of different issues, whether it be foreign policy, China, taxation, domestic spending. Those are all issues that, impact our lives greatly and also impact, financially our portfolios. So we very much appreciate your time and appreciate what you do for UBS and what you do for our clients. And thank you again for, a great 45 minutes, very, very insightful. And we appreciate you spending time with us.
Mark, thank you. And thank you, Craig. And I just want to say a word to the clients. If you ever have any Washington interests or questions, or if you're trying to connect the dots on what may happen with something that's of importance to you, let Mark and Craig know, and they can get in touch with me. Consider me to be a part of their team, and certainly happy to help you if you have any needs in Washington, D.C. Thanks for the time today.